Good morning. So, most of you know, but I'm Tim Burkett. I'm the guiding teacher here, and I'm reading from my new book, Nothing Holy, about it today. And then during tea, we'll have books for sale, and I'll sign them. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. So, all of my life, I've been practicing Zen meditation. I started when I was not quite 21. And I met my wife at San Francisco Zen Center 50 years ago this month. And I've been giving talks here at this Zen Center since I was ordained here by the founding teacher, Katagiri Roshi, 37 years ago. Right? So don't be intimidated by that. That's just time passing. You know, time does pass. This book is an artful arrangement of portions of specific talks that I've given over the last 10 years by Wanda Isle. Wanda, where are you? Wanda Isle, back in the very back, who did a yeoman's job of transcribing, editing, and crafting them with help from others. This book was supposed to be dedicated to all you guys, but it got left out in the first printing. It was supposed to be dedicated to all people who practiced here in the past at this Zen Center, in the present, and in the future. So maybe if there's a second printing, we'll get it in. I began my Zen practice, as I said, before I was 21 years old in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is where I'm from. I'm going to let these couple more people get seated. I guess I'll just let these come. Yeah, since somebody's opening windows, that's a good idea. I had gone through a phase where I was not going to classes in college, and instead I was reading over and over again teachings of the mystics, and I went into some meditative states. I didn't even know about meditation, and then I had a spontaneous opening in which the small Tim just fell away, and there was a feeling of being joined to all life. So then I went back to college, and that was just a memory. But I really wanted it back, big time, big time. So I thought, well, San Francisco has a huge Chinese population. There's got to be some Zen up there. So I went to my college library, Stanford, and I looked under Z, and there was a Zen bar and a Zen center. And I thought, well, what shall I try out first? Well, you know, I was already pretty well educated in bars. I would say I was over-educated in bars. So I went up to the Zen Center, which, of course, was not in Chinatown. And that's how I began my practice. And I met my root teacher, Suzuki Roshi, up there. This book includes stories I've woven into my teaching over the years about my Zen teachers and their impact. My root teacher, Suzuki Roshi, author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which many of you have read, and the founding teacher of this center, Katagiri Roshi, who took a chance and ordained me many years ago and hoped for the best, and this is what he got. About 10 years ago, I grouped a series of little vignettes, memory vignettes, from my experiences with my teachers, Suzuki, Katagiri, and others, into a five or eight page handout that I thought, well, maybe I can get this published in a magazine. I showed it to a few people, and when I showed it to Wanda Isle back there, she said, well, this should be part of a book. And I said, a book? She said, yes, we should weave your teachings and your talks over the last dozen years into a book. So she did it. She did it. She was willing to roll up her sleeves and work over several years, and lo and behold, this book is about my journey, beginning when I was 20 to now, and the influence of my teachers, and how Zen, it's also about how Zen teaching and how meditation practice can be transformative for anyone, for everyone. So I'm going to read from it now. The first section I'm going to read from is from longing to aspiration. So usually when we get into a meditation practice, at least up until now, it's because of longing. We don't grow up in Buddhist families, right? We didn't grow up in families where there was meditation going on, but it's some dissatisfaction, pretty deep dissatisfaction in our lives, with our lives, some anxiety or sense that we want a deep peace, we'd like a deep peace. So this section from longing to aspiration, and I'm just dipping into it here. There's a story about Suzuki and Katagiri on a plane flying over the Midwest. Suzuki pointed out the window and said, "That is where the real Americans live. They all have jobs." This is the late 1960s, you guys. He was referring to his experience with us early counterculture ne'er-do-wells in San Francisco. For Katagiri, this statement turned out to be prophetic. In 1972, a group of Zen practitioners from Minneapolis flew to San Francisco to meet with Katagiri Sensei and ask for his help. Suzuki was dead by then, but Katagiri remembered that he had said about the Midwest. He agreed to go to Minneapolis and lead a retreat. By this time, I had left California. By sheer coincidence, I was living in northern Minnesota. But I was not part of the Minneapolis group and knew nothing of their effort to persuade Katagiri to move here. As a matter of fact, when I left San Francisco, I never expected to see Katagiri again. So I was surprised to hear he was coming to Minnesota and excited to see him. I drove down for the retreat, which was in the home of a guy named Eric Storley. On the first day, I went into Doksan, a private meeting with Katagiri. I couldn't believe I was seeing him again. But he could. His first words were, "I thought I'd see you again, Tim." This was the first Zen retreat in Minnesota, led by a trained teacher. Among the small group of practitioners who attended was a man named Cal Appleby, who has since become my friend and is still very active in the Zen community in Minneapolis. He sat the entire retreat in full lotus, his back as straight as an arrow. I've never been able to sit in full lotus. Every time I glanced at Cal, I felt a stab of jealousy. Sitting that way seemed rude. He probably still sits in full lotus, and he's older than I am. Throughout the retreat, Katagiri talked about planting the seeds of Zen and watching them sprout. I thought, oh yes, that's his dim vision. A few years later, he became the first Zen teacher to ordain priests in the Midwest. He ordained two students, Norm Randolph and me. We were a small part of his dim vision. So dim vision is a word that has a very negative connotation in early Buddhism. We're blinded. Our vision becomes dim because of all the worries and anxieties and planning and remembering and reviewing and rehearsing that goes on. So our vision is dim. But the teacher Dogen turned around and said, no, we all have dim vision. Everybody, even if you do meditation for 30 years, you still have stuff come up. And dim vision is really wonderful because it can be your aspiration. Your aspiration is for how you want to be, how you want to be. We were all a small part of his dim vision. Today, Katagiri Roshi's seeds have sprouted all over the country. The Minnesota Zen Meditation Center on Lake Calhoun in Uptown, oh, here we are, huh? is renowned because it was created by Katagiri Roshi's dim vision. the next section, becoming who you already are. It's the nature of the mind to judge, compare, and complain. It's the purpose of Zen meditation to experience the mind's gyrations directly. When we turn the mind back onto itself, it starts to slow down on its own. It becomes focused and concentrated. We do it by bringing ourselves back again and again with kind, patient attention. Without kindness and patience, the mind will never settle down. When I first began my Zen practice, every time I sat down on the cushion, my mind shifted into high gear. One morning, I shared my frustration with Suzuki Sensei. I asked for a technique to slow down my racing mind. He said, "A busy mind is no problem. Just sit, Tim, that's all." And I said, "Should I repeat something to myself, thinking maybe a mantra or some kind might help?" He said, no, just sit." "But shouldn't I do something with my mind?" No, just come sit with me," he repeated gently. "Can't you give me some books to read?" He shot me a puzzled look. "Why would you want to read a book?" "Well, how often should I sit?" "Every morning and every night." "Every morning and every night, and there's no how?" So both of my teachers followed Dogen, the founder of Soto Zen, in really de-emphasizing technique. I probably use it a little more. I do use it a little more than they did. But their concern was, and the concern still is, that technique gets in the way of just being with what is. Just being what it is, with just kind, bare awareness. And because technique, we're always trying to get something. That's why, while I was very puzzled back then, I now see this as a wonderful gesture of generosity on my teacher's part. The next thing I want to dip into is from Too Much Emptiness, A Cup of Tea. After an 8-week retreat at our monastery in Carmel Valley, which was named Tassajara Zen Mountain Monastery, I returned to San Francisco and immediately took a bus to the D. Young Museum. I was still in the afterglow of the long retreat. In a meditative state, I walked through the museum slowly, soaking it all in as I made my way to the Asian collection. When I came to the first Buddha statue, I stopped, or rather I was stopped by it, captivated by the peaceful expression that seemed to mirror what I was feeling inside. I felt an incredible stillness emanating from it. When I looked into the Buddha's eyes, they seemed to open up into pure space. I felt as if I were teetering on the edge of something. Instinctively, I turned away. But just a few feet away, there was another statue. Its eyes were also like deep holes into no thingness. Again, I turned away, but the statues were everywhere. Infinitely vacant eyes were everywhere. I was overwhelmed and by now completely disoriented. With difficulty, I managed to get back to the bus. Still disoriented, I headed straight to the Zen Center. I stumbled up the stairs and plopped down on the couch in Suzuki's office. He greeted me in a friendly but mildly concerned manner and then asked what was going on. I told him about the statues. The spaciousness emanating from their eyes had pierced me to my core. There were no thoughts bubbling up in my mind. My body felt awkward, unable to adjust to this sudden shift. "Which statues?" Suzuki asked, which seemed totally irrelevant. But I told him where I had been in the museum and described the statues I saw there. "Let's have a cup of tea," he said. That was the end. That was the end. So those of you who get seriously into meditation may sometime have an experience where you're disoriented when you let go of your thoughts. When you let go, I mean, we're so conditioned to thinking all the time. We're so conditioned to having these thoughts as kind of a protective shell. We think we want to get beyond them, but actually, sometimes it can be very disorienting, very disorienting. But all Suzuki did was give me a cup of tea, and then I went home. And I woke up the next morning, I just felt regular. This section, living beyond the fear body. Once, as I was driving Suzuki home after our Palo Alto City group, he asked if I would take him to an area in Hillsboro. He wanted to visit a woman who'd contacted him about Buddhism. He had never met this woman, but he felt he should go visit her. Well, I wasn't too happy about it because I was supposed to be in class, but I did it anyway. Actually, I was happy about it. I was not into going to classes at that stage of my life. His directions weren't good. We drove around for some time before we found the house. It was on a large, spacious estate in a wealthy suburb. As I said recently, this is my second reading. Every time I think about it, the estate gets larger and the house gets larger. Suzuki said, "You stay here, I'll go up." So I waited. But after only about 5 minutes, he came back. "How'd it go?" I asked. "Very interesting," he said. "But not the woman I thought. Wrong woman." Then he started to laugh. "She thought I was there to wash her windows," he exclaimed with delight. "But I didn't bring my window washing equipment." He chortled with great amusement. It was easy to see how she'd made the mistake. A Japanese man dressed in a simple black jacket and baggy black pants. This was 1965, just 20 years after World War II, when many Japanese on the West Coast had been forced into relocation camps. They'd lost all their property. Some of them had actually done very well, but they were back to the beginning. They'd lost everything, their money, their property, their stature. Even 20 years later, the only Japanese folks I saw in the Bay Area were laborers before I met Suzuki. So when Suzuki went to the wrong house, it's sad, but understandable that the woman thought he was there to wash her windows. The fear body would feel demeaned by this, because it's always concerned about what others think. Suzuki didn't feel demeaned. He lived beyond the fear body. He could accommodate himself to his environment without getting caught by it, because he was bigger than his environment. It was more as if he had pulled a practical joke on her, because he kept talking to me. He said, "You have those squeegee. I should have brought squeegee." I said, "Yes, do you have one?" He said, "No, I should get one." Okay, let's see. Oh, well, here's one of sentimental value to me. My love minus zero mantra. After my first year of Zen practice, the austerity of sitting still and doing nothing did not seem to be working for me anymore. Anybody experience that? Anybody experience that? Even Suzuki Roshi was not working for me. Anybody experience that? Anybody experience that? Though I kept sitting with him every morning and evening. To make the early morning meditation, I sometimes stayed up all night. I don't know. I don't see people doing that anymore, but that's what I did. Because when I started doing meditation, I already stayed up till 1 or 2 with my friends, so staying up till 5 was certainly much better than having to get up at 5. I sat at an all-night diner in San Francisco, drinking coffee and staring out the window into the fog and darkness until it was time to go to the Zen Center. Well, what a way to calm the mind. This was about the time Bob Dylan came out with his album, Bringing It All Back Home. Four lines from two verses in the song, Love Minus Zero, No Limit, became my mantra. My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She knows there's no success like failure, and that failure is no success at all. The first line, "My love, she speaks like silence," was about my teacher. Sensei seemed to speak like silence. Silence went with him, wherever he went. It wasn't a rigid, heavy, reverent kind of silence. It was light and spacious, a brilliant silence, an ordinary silence. I was romanced by that silence. I sensed something wonderful in it and was drawn to it. I'm still romanced by that silence, but not the silence of any one person, by the silence that is present in all beings. After almost 50 years, I'm still awed by the great silence that surrounds and imbues everything, without ideals or violence. One reason practice became so hard for me was that I had an ideal that I was clinging to. My ideal was that I should do Zen practice with grace. But I was stumbling through it with no grace at all. Ideals are frequently about should and shouldn't. They have nothing to do with what's actually going on. Too often they provoke violent thoughts. We are limited and bullied by them. Just showing up each morning and evening was all I needed to do. I didn't need to compare my Zen practice with some ideal. The more rigidly idealistic we are, the more violent we become on the inside. So I'll read about three more, and then we can have a little conversation. This is from a section, Empty Mind. When Katagiri Roshi was abbot of Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, the scholar Robert Thurman came to speak. Robert seemed delighted with Katagiri. He appreciated him for the great teacher that he was. When Robert returned to his own center in Massachusetts, he invited Katagiri to come and give some talks. I went along as his attendant. We were both outsiders there, and Katagiri Roshi amazed me. I thought, just look at this guy. He's wonderful. I had listened to Katagiri day after day, year after year, but that week he amazed me. Was it my mind? Was I no longer anticipating his every move? I had been so close to him for so long, I'd forgotten how to appreciate him. I had to become an outsider to see him with fresh eyes. And of course, the people in Massachusetts were so attentive and open to him. They appreciated the stillness he manifested because they were not accustomed to him. On the way back to Minnesota, on the plane, I talked with Katagiri about how good he was and about how much everyone loved him. "I bet you wish you could have stayed there," I said. He said, "Oh," he sighed, "they would just get used to me too." This is what we do as human beings. But it's all in our own head. So after we got back, I tried to do a better job of keeping my mind fresh and appreciative of Katagiri's gifts. It worked for a while. But then I settled back in my critical way of thinking. I regret that. I'm sorry I wasn't more supportive and attentive to Katagiri Roshi. So Suzuki Roshi's comment, in the beginner's mind, there are many opportunities. In the expert's mind, there are few. That's what this reminds me of. And that's why meditation really is a lifetime endeavor, because we always get used to things. And then we can come back to just breathing, just being here, and see the world freshly. See the world freshly. Two more readings. This one is called Suzuki Roshi's Counterculture. "800 years after Dogen, Suzuki Roshi breathed new life into Buddha's original counterculture. He made it come alive again. Everything he did seemed to arise from the ground of his being." The same ground as Buddha in India, Bodhidharma in Hanshan in China, and Dogen in Japan. Like Dogen, Suzuki felt that Buddhism in Japan had taken on a corpus of fear. He came to America seeking an enclave of fresh ground to cultivate. He discovered a wellspring, but it was unlike anything he could have imagined. On November 13, 1967, to raise money to buy Tassajara, we organized a Zenefit held in the Avalon Ballroom in San Francisco. And actually, after I did my first reading, someone went online and found the poster for that and sent it to me. The concert featured performances by the Grateful Dead, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Brick Brother and the Holding Company, and Janis Joplin. Although in the poster that this person sent me, Janis Joplin's name wasn't on there. The others all were, but she wasn't there. Interesting. Artists who have since become legendary. I didn't usually go to the Haight-Ashbury district because it wasn't my scene, but I went to the Zenefit. The auditorium was full. Light effects emanated from strobe lights and lasers mounted throughout the theater. Pungent odors filled the air. People were dressed or undressed in an amazing variety of regalia, and the huge sounds of 60s rock boomed from the stage. Katagiri Sensei had been in the United States for only 2 years at that time. He was reserved, quiet, and a very gentle presence. I remember seeing him standing anxiously in the shadows, half hidden, and looking quite out of sorts and unsettled in that crazy environment. He looked as if he wanted to run away. I'm sure he did. Suzuki was older and had been doing resiliency practice for years and years. Also, he'd been in San Francisco by that time for almost 9 years, so he had, quote, unquote, gotten used to this group. He sat in the front of the theater with lights flashing on him from all directions. What a memorable sight. Surrounded by utter chaos, he was completely relaxed and seemed totally in his element. He was looking around, smiling, taking it all in. I think he was grooving on the whole thing. Finally, the last performer, the amazing blues singer Janis Joplin, took the stage. She gave it her all. Talk about shedding the fear of body. In front of 1,000 people, she bared her heart and soul in a classic Janis performance. Then it was time for Suzuki to say something to the crowd. The auditorium grew silent as he crossed to the microphone. When he spoke, his voice was calm and warm. At first, he said, I think your way very different from ours. But now I see not so different, not so different. The crowd roared. Suzuki was touched by Janice's ability to shed her fear body and give her whole heart to others. People responded to her in a visceral way. Janis imbibed the music. It seemed to come from the ground of her being. But she didn't have a practice that cultivated resiliency. She could bear her soul on stage in front of people, but privately her life was tragic. Less than 3 years after the Zenefit, she was dead. So, if you've seen the book Crooked Cucumber about Suzuki Roshi, you know that he had interest in coming to an English-speaking country and teaching Zen for many years. And he did because he wanted to manifest the Buddhist counterculture. Buddhism started as a counterculture in India. It was a counter to the Brahma caste system. And where only the Brahmins, people in the Brahmin caste, could attain enlightenment and could help other people attain enlightenment, and other people had to do obeisance to them and give them stuff and all that. So he was a counter. It was originally a counterculture. By the time it went into China, it was no longer a counterculture. It was very established. And early Chinese, full of rituals, full of rules, lots of hierarchy. But then we have a counterculture again. The birth of Zen is a counterculture in China, with people like Bodhidharma, Anshan, Shite, Hote, united by their wonderful spirit to discover and joyfully manifest this stillness that's always here. And, you know, they're known for their outrageous behavior, although they never hurt anybody, and their raucous laughter. So it was a counterculture. Then Buddhism in China got established. The golden age of Chinese Zen ended in around 900. And as an establishment religion, you know, there were all these priests. They owned a lot of land. The monks didn't get rich because they weren't allowed to have money, but the monasteries got rich. And so when Dogen went to China in the 1200s, he was very disappointed from Japan. He thought Japan, Buddhism is corrupt there. They're all interested in spirits and philosophy and a ritual. So he thought he was going back to the original. But by then, China, it had become very stultified, and China entered the dominant culture and it lost its vivaciousness. So then, but Dogen found this one old guy we thought manifested this, and he had a wonderful experience with him, and so he tried to bring it back. So he brought it back to the beginning of real Japanese Zen as we know it. But then Suzuki was not satisfied in Japan himself. And he met a woman named Miss Ransom in 1927 when he was in his early 20s and a young priest. And he liked her. She was British, but he didn't know the difference between British and American. And he thought, I'd like to go there because those people are not, and I'm paraphrasing him, but he did talk about this stuff back then. They're not bogged down by ritual. They actually like to do zazen. They want to do zazen. They want to explore. They have a longing. So he got this all from Miss Ransom, who was his English teacher, and was British. They would have tea every day. And so when he got the opportunity to come to San Francisco when he was in his late 50s, he wanted to do it when he was young, but he never had that opportunity in the war and all, poverty and all that stuff. He thought, wow, you know, here. But he discovered a different counterculture than he had expected. He expected a whole bunch of Miss Ransoms. And instead of disciplined, modest, well-regulated practice, which is what we do here, he saw undisciplined, immodest, unregulated life, right? So that was these are the coming together of these two countercultures, which has resulted in this, in what we're doing here in some way. So they're the same in that both of these cultures embrace the present moment. Have a real affinity to nature, to the natural world. And both of them embrace, even though that 60s counterculture is kind of gone, I don't think it's entirely gone, giving ourselves wholeheartedly to each activity, as Janice did on the stage, which is what so deeply moved him, I think. I mean, I never talked to him about this afterwards. Also the same in the belief that we can move beyond our small, constricted self to embrace something immense, something wonderful, something we can't put our fingers on and we don't need to put our fingers on. But, of course, there's a difference in how we do this, obviously. We do this without chemicals. We did this through our own commitment to a sustained meditation practice. And through this, we discover and manifest the joys of a stillness through the simplest activities of daily life, the simplest activities. So I want to close by one final reading. Not long after I had my Satori experience at Tassajara, I went in for Dokusan with Suzuki. He looked at my shoes strewn by the door where I had kicked them off. They were dirty and disheveled. I keep reading that, and I think they couldn't have been that dirty and disheveled. I must have been a slob. Well, no, I won't have it. I won't tell you. I won't talk to you about that. You know what we were, we still are. It doesn't matter how much zazen we do. What we were, we still are. They were dirty and disheveled. His were tidy and placed carefully, side by side. I had never noticed that before. I can't believe I'd never noticed that before. That's what I said, I guess. Now that you are so-called enlightened, he said, it's time to take care of those, as he glanced at my shoes. I wasn't interested in my shoes. Zen was an opportunity to transcend the physical, to experience something beyond ordinary. I was often frustrated by Suzuki's reluctance to give us the real stuff. What did my shoes have to do with emptiness? We stay connected to the world through what we do, not what we think. It's important that we fully engage in our lives. Today, people frequently come into one-to-one to talk about their ideas of Zen, about Zen with me. I don't want to be rude, so I listen, but I'm not very interested in that. The bigger question is, what are you going to do? And how are you going to live? Life as a human being is short. What are you going to do with your time here? When Ram Dass asked his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, how can I be enlightened? Baba said, love people, feed people, love people. Later, Ram Dass went back again and asked, but what's the best path to awakening? Baba said, feed people, love people, feed people. So Ram Dass worked to help establish a community based on Baba's teachings in the United States. He tried and failed. Then he went to Baba and asked, what's the best technique for establishing community? Baba said, love people, feed people, love people. Dogen said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. We just study the self continuously, moment by moment. There's nothing more to do. We start this practice by studying the small self. Eventually, we meet our true boundaryless self. Love arises naturally from the ground of our being, which is the ground of all being. To study the self is to forget the self. When we penetrate the small self, we move beyond it. We begin to trust interconnectedness, the way a bird trusts the tree it builds its nest in. This is actually from the historical Buddha, that comment. Trust is the realization that in an interdependent universe, all beings are completely nourished. To forget the self is to be intimate with all life. So I'd like to pause now and see what questions or comments folks have. We have about 10 minutes. So, questions, comments? About anything?
Tim?
Yeah?
Did you finally find the right house after you went to the wrong one?
No, I don't know what ever happened. No. He just had the, you know, the address on a piece of paper that he scrawled. You know, we didn't have iPhones and email, and you know, we were wandering around Hillsboro, which is a bit, you know. I just barely managed to find my way back to San Francisco with him. I don't know, I never found out what happened. Who else? Yeah.
You mentioned the pain body, and I haven't been around long enough.
I mentioned the fear body.
The fear body.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if you can talk about what that is about. I know Eckhart Tolle talked about, I think the pain body might be the fear body.
Well, I haven't read Eckhart Tolle, but that's cool. But he talks about that. So we are hardwired to develop a fear body. Because we need to protect ourselves from the elements. We need to protect ourselves from other people. We need to protect our families. And we developed that fear body centuries ago to protect ourselves against wild animals, against a scary environment. So we have a fear body. And what we call ego includes that fear body. Actually, I think that we could say that fear body encapsulates ego. That's the shell of ego. So it's important, but we become so constrained by it. We become so worried and fearful, and we only see through the fear body. We become so heavy. It's like we're carrying around this weight on us all the time, which is the fear body worrying about who's going to do what to us and how we should prepare and what happened before. And so we overdo it. It becomes our whole scene. And seeing through this fear body is part of a key component of this process. But you can't will it. You can will it, but that's just actually more of the fear body willing that it be something different than what it already is. Welcome. Who else?
Hi. Thank you for taking time to read from the book. One of the excerpts that you read from that resonated with me was when you were talking about that need to follow the what came out to me was that need for control.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So personally, I'm a yogi. That's what I practice. And you know, you get caught in your personal practice, you know, well, the book or this YouTube video or this teacher told you to do it this way. Sometimes there's like variation. People will tell you different things on how to do a proper one. I'll show you, I don't know, like warrior one and warrior two.
Yes.
But then at the same time, it's like I feel like this need for the control to say, well, this book said this, so I'm going to follow by this book's guidelines or this book's rules. But then also that balance between listening to your intuition, listening to your higher intellect, you know, and knowing what's best for your body. So it was just that resonated with me, that little excerpt that you were talking about, like this balance between control and intuition.
Yes, yes. And I think what you're pointing out is that we need both, actually. That we say that's the middle way. And I mean, it takes discipline and control to have a sitting practice, to have a yogic practice. But if we get if we do too much thinking about what we're accomplishing by doing it, we miss the possibility of really being so close to it that we just enjoy the experience of it, of doing it, and that it's not even we enjoying the experience, it's the experience enjoying the experience. So thank you for articulating that. Time for one or two more. Yes. Hi.
Because historically Buddhism has gotten entrenched several kinds.
Yes.
Do we need to be careful moving forward?
Well, we do. Did you hear what she said? She said, because Buddhism has gotten caught being entrenched several times, do we need to be careful moving forward? We need to be careful, but we're going to do it anyway. Yes, we do need to be careful. But we'll do it because we are pattern human beings. We can see beyond pattern and have a great opening. But we are patterned, and we all become habituated to certain patterns. So we need, we hope for a continual inner revolution, so that we're continually seeing through our patterns. I would say that this will inevitably happen. Why would it not happen in Zen? But maybe it will happen. It will, maybe in 50 years there'll be another internal reformation or something. But right now, you know, we're still in the counterculture in this country, so we're cool. But now that I see, but now that I see how meditation is becoming so well accepted, I think, uh-oh. Because then people develop a very specific habitual way of relating to it. And that specific habitual way of relating to it mars their ability to just open up to the timelessness that's always here. It's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Good question. Yeah, well, I won't be around. You're younger than me. Maybe you'll be around. Anything else? Thank you.